we'll start our panel discussion. Obviously, as I said before, I think I'm going back to carrier pigeon and whispering now. And we've also learned today that cybercrime isn't, it's a new type of crime, obviously. Robbery and extortion isn't a mask and a gun anymore. It's done through bits and bytes and over the internet. If we have some questions for the panel, for Jeff and for Dennis. Lady here in the white, please. So that would be the lady in the white, yes.
Well, you know, first of all, Vault-X has developed software and semiconductor technologies. So what we're pitching to the education sector and into the oil and gas, you know, people with some money, what we're saying is this, is that we have the technology, we can provide it to secure XP 100% from attack without a further update from Microsoft. I've got XP machines running at home that I have not updated for 3 years, and I'm absolutely certain, 100% certain, that the image I put on there is exactly what's on there.
So just to kind of go off that,
are you considering moving into healthcare as well? Because you know, what we're articulating for that all the computers in the country need to be secured, be it from whether it's military, government, enterprise, critical infrastructure, SMB, consumers, all have to be secured. And that's to protect the country. You know, when we look at specific things, when we look at education sector or healthcare, yes, there's a lot of there in the records in the healthcare sector. But even when we look at the education sector, and let me talk a little bit more about K-12 than the universities, right? In K-12, we want our students protected. We don't want the students tracked, etc. So there's, when we look at any segment, it's important to have the things protected. And then, you know, as a company, there's in the IT world, there's always been a break for education, right? So, for example, you know, if we're selling a product for $150, education gets it for $8.
Well, actually, just last night, I donated $4 million to myself, courtesy of the government. So I wish it was that easy. I can't stipulate as to what security measures are in place for the federal government. And I say that sincerely. I honestly don't know. It's not that a matter of masking any potential threat or security thereof. I can't tell you what steps they do go through. I wish I could answer that for you. Perhaps Dennis can. From a policing standpoint, I at least know the context that I can make in order to investigate the breaches that have occurred. Their investigators are far more advanced than the law enforcement community, given the fact they have the money for financial backing to provide that to the investigators. And again, their idea is recovery, not prosecution. There's a vast difference between the two. Right? In order to make a proper prosecution, there's a lot more, a bigger threshold to find that information out. Whereas if it's a recovery issue, the banks can deal with that.
Just a comment on the federal government. So National Research Council has been hacked. Revenue Canada has been hacked. Number of government departments have been hacked. Let's put it this way, they know nothing about cybersecurity. Okay? So I was in Silicon Valley last April, and some folks came up, communication security establishment, and I hope none of them are here today, because they wanted me to say something nice about antivirus, and I told them, no, it's garbage, I'm not saying anything nice. And now our consultants are saying, be nice to CSE, because they're our NSA.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And when I spoke of the one change that C-13 would bring, that's one of the few that I adhere to as being a necessity. Because as it stands right now, when I get those complainants coming forward to me, albeit an adult person saying there's a nude image of me posted online, I said, go on. I said, no, that's it. I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do for you. Unless there's an element of extortion behind it, a mischief or see it's that nude image being online, the laws do not protect that image from being eradicated. The platform on which it's appearing on might have a user agreement that can pull that information down. But as we know with the internet, I mean, once something goes out, the potential of it going viral or even networked is far greater than the speed in which it would be required to take it down. So to say that the laws in place right now are sufficient is difficult to say. Criminal harassment makes out the threshold for online criminal harassment. It's the exact same series of offenses. Online threatening is threatening, right? There are laws in place that we can use to prosecute offenses that are occurring online. Some changes do need to be made, but I don't believe it needs to be drastic. Drastic's already happened.
Yeah. Right?
Nothing's going to change.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely it is. And we look at the incident, as we mentioned before, of swatting. Hey, that's a really cool idea. I'm trying that tonight. Next guy hears about it. They do it as well. It's copycatting occurs. Cyberbullying occurs. And I make an analogy in another presentation where 30 years ago, somebody would slap a sign on my back saying, Jeff sucks. And the only people that are going to see that are in the vicinity of where I am at the school. You do that now with the hashtag in front of it, and it's not going away. And the impact is far greater than it would have been 30 years ago. Disaster's already happened. We just have to manipulate the laws right now in order to prosecute that better. Whether or not it's an aggravating factor of sentencing, it's a possibility.
Gentleman back there in the kitchen.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. Yeah, all the above, actually. One of the priorities for the service is not only to incorporate technology in our investigations, but a bigger component to that is making people aware of cyberbullying. And I got to say, I hate using that term because it's criminal harassment, right? But let's call it bullying just for argument's sake because the terminology is out there and quite common. We want to increase the amount of reports that are being forwarded to us and increase the amount of times that we can actually become involved in that. The only way to increase that is to increase everyone's awareness of what it is, right? So in order to safeguard that, we do regularly go into schools, not myself personally, but there are people out there that can give a presentation on this is how dangerous Snapchat is, right? That 10-second photo that you sent to your friend is never going away, right? And this is how it's being used. This is what Facebook's all about. This is Twitter. And we show the profiles and platforms of the dangers and the pitfalls.
Next question is gentleman back there. Yep.
Sorry, Dennis. Yeah, you speak anonymously, as in somebody using an anonymous profile or an anonymous organization?
Yep. Obviously, there's more of a deterrent factor when you go commit a crime in real life, and the person you're a lot more likely to get caught, this and that, and whereas on the internet, you at least feel like there's a sense of security because you feel like you're relatively anonymous, and it's easier to press a couple buttons than it is to, walk into a soldier's gun.
I think that by acknowledging that anonymity exists and that there is ways to combat that and making people aware that becoming an e-thug is not as simple as you think it is, right? It's people that are sitting behind a keyboard spewing out this bile, thinking that, I'm just going off the whim here and it's not going to affect anybody and they're not going to find out who I am. When we start to show cases where we've actually discovered who they are and arrested them, it shows that anonymity isn't exactly as true as they believe it to be, right? That adds to the credence of how dangerous a threat can be posed online. Because if my wife's brother threatens to kill me, I can tell the police, it's my wife's brother. He sent me a letter with a stamp on it. Right? It's him. Online, who threatened you? The York Fox 32. Well, who's that? Right? We don't know. So additional steps have to be taken. But true sense of anonymity is only an illusion. I believe it is.
Isn't just a grand concept that we think of, it affects people on a day-to-day basis.
wondering if you could comment on whether when such things happen, it should be taken as not only a cybercrime of any, like you said, a criminal harassment, but also sexual assault if it's underage.
Yeah, and that's one thing that the legislation hasn't quite made clear as to the determination of an offense occurring online. With the Amanda Todd, for instance, it was an image of her, or a video of her breast being exposed. Could it fit the criteria of a sexual assault under today's standards? No. Right. But there are, again, we do have the laws in place that can at least afford some form of prosecution. New legislation could very well be brought up that would make that in, along the same lines of physical assault.
You know, I think, you know, the approach that's been taken in the U.S. is that people have to be informed. Keeping quiet about it won't solve the problem. So, and especially, you know, when we take a look at things like identity theft, et cetera, the faster somebody is informed, right, the more we are informed about things, we can act quickly to it, you know. And you know, and just, you know, just another point, you know, for a company like ours, we're a for-profit company, and, you know, and we're looking to, you know, make some big bucks. We're really humbled by the work folks like Jeff are doing, because when you take a look at the Amanda Todd story, the bullying, the things that are happening there, there's more important things, right? And so the more you talk about it, when we talk about these things, then it becomes known. And especially we hope we reach those students, as gentlemen up there, you know, ask the question as to, are you letting the students know? The more we talk about the cyberbullying, et cetera, the more we talk about things that are happening, then the students become aware and the young folks become aware that this should not be done. And that's very, very important to get the message out.
And that's an interesting balance, because that threshold to convict is higher. I have to put more emphasis into that investigation. However, the privacy laws are is equally as high as that threshold to prosecute. So my unit specifically is reaction driven. We will go to an investigation once we become aware of it. So in an example of a, again, completely fictitiously, a group of individuals who are robbing banks downtown. If that information has now become public and we're being required to investigate it, and somebody has captured a picture of that vehicle online, well, of course, that's where I'm going to start looking. I want to see where else that picture is being used. I want to see if anybody online has posted that as a profile photo. I need to make sure that I can do everything I can through open source to make sure that I can find that individual is responsible for that bank robbery. The data mining is specific to the case itself, and it's imperative for the investigation.
You know, what I'd say is that, you know, a lot of the information is held resident by the internet service providers. The ISPs have access to information, unless, you know, the criminals have gone to extensive methods to conceal themselves, right? So what we view is what we are doing is good, right, in terms of the protection, identity thefts, protecting your computers from being attacked, etc. But for a company like us involved in technology, one of the key things is when we hear what Jeff is doing, then we'll start to think. We'll start to think about what can we do? Can we develop technologies that makes Jeff's job and his team's job easier? And that's something we will certainly look at in terms of, previously I've been able to look at databases and look at things, and you can pinpoint the criminals, right? No source of income, multi-million dollar apartments, etc., right? You know, and you go, where's the money coming from? But certainly the technology companies, once you know the problem has been identified, and we can start then to work towards developing the solutions that will help.
So you're not there yet?
Not there yet.
No, and conversely, in order for us to use that evidence, it has to be received in such a way that wouldn't have constituted a privacy breach to begin with as well. So when we talk about IPs being captured, I still am then required to write judicial authorization to the ISP to get registration information. The Regina versus Spencer's, and it pinpoints exactly what the police and law enforcement agencies can and cannot do in terms of what is public and what is private. And to intercept any information, and we're not talking interception of data, we're talking registration information of an IP requires judicial authorization. So it can be made aware through third-party companies in the public sector, but we still need additional resources and, again, judicial authorization to get that data.
We're going to do two more questions. I'm going to take a bit more time. The gentleman in the blue shirt and the gentleman in the gray back start with the gentleman in the blue shirt.
This is a comment for Dennis. Your comment in red on your slide there is interesting. In the telco sector, there's a lot of pressure to impose supply chain security from chips all the way to towers, and especially in the core network. So I wonder if you've explored doing this presentation for CSTAT or CTCP. CSTAT is a medium-level telco industrial forum for national security. And CSTAT is more of a working model of civil security.
We'd be happy to do that. We just hired on recently a company, a very high-level defense company, to represent us in Ottawa. I've just come back from a trip to Washington where they asked me to come to Washington to discuss the manufacture on a secure supply chain scenario where they wanted us to be for a certain market of classified and secure military systems. They want us to actually manufacture our chips right from the start through a known secure supply chain in there. So certainly we'd be open to that in getting involved in that. And really the NATO thing comes into play because we have the NATO partnership with Canada, USA, and our NATO partners. Hopefully they would have a system in place that once you manufacture securely in a secure supply chain, in a NATO nation, that would be adopted by other NATO nations. And I do know for cybersecurity that NATO does have an approval process where you can get your products approved for it. But certainly I'd be happy to get your input on that and leave you a card and follow up on it. Well, what we've done is this. So malware, ransomware, et cetera, ransomware in particular, takes a hold of your computer system, just locks it, and won't let you go, right? You got to pay, right? So that's why we've developed this Vault-X technology. The Vault-X technology, software, and semiconductors, what we're saying is nothing can attack your system. You restart that system, it's absolutely clean according to what you've put on there. We actually developed the technology from the education sector. My company, my previous company supplied computers to the K-12 education sector. No matter how good a computer we supplied, the kids, the high school kids, would hack the computers, right? And so we set out to actually develop a technology that would prevent high school students from hacking computers. And then we found out there was a cybersecurity problem, right? So this is exactly what our technology does. We're a Canadian company. We'd appreciate the support moving forward on it. But the antiviruses and all that are absolutely useless. One of the tests with antivirus is this. If you take 10 antivirus products that are in Symantec McAfee's database, they will miss 3 out of 10 of what they know about, because it's a 500 million item database. And they'll miss 95% or maybe 100% of all the new attacks happening today. So the whole idea is lock it. You got it. It's valuable. Lock it. And now you own it. Nobody else owns it.
Yeah. A quick question on that. I just out of curiosity. When someone does get one of these cyber situations where they've locked your computer, says you need $150 to unload it, put in your credit card, do they actually take the $150 or they jack you $10,000?
Well, no. Yeah. So what is it? They will release you. Sometimes they'll charge you twice. Right? And the thing is, you know, and those things are, you know, those things are tough to get rid of. You know, I've had the priests from the local church come over, and they'll be locked, right? And then we got to, you know, take the drive. Really, all you can do is take the drive and wipe it, right? And start over fresh again. But the whole thing with this is, they pay the hacker, they pay people to do the marketing. The marketing is actually the hacking of the computers. And the guys who are collecting the money, they go, for $100,000, we can get 50,000 hits to the call center. And then they go, well, Dennis, come down to Florida. We'd like to talk about upselling your product after they've been hacked. And I go, so, geez, I don't know. I don't think I want to get involved with those kind of people.
Just to further that point as well, one thing I should preface is that we have a tech crime unit within the Toronto Police Service. Their only job is hardware forensics. That's not what my team is actually involved with. So if during the course of our investigation, we determine that it's a ransomware attack, it's not an online component, essentially. It's a hardware issue. So we'll give it right to the team, and they can deal with the forensics aspect of it. Now, to be quite honest, after the screen on the computer, I don't know what happens behind it. Right? That's not my forte. So Dennis can speak better on that, but I can tell you that we do have teams in place that can forensically analyze computers and eliminate those threats as well.
No. Great. Hey, gentlemen, thank you to both of you, and appreciate your help.